Let me in. Shiba, shiba. I want to be closer to you. Shiba, shiba. Open up your soul. Shiba, shiba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your
love. Oh, let why don't you let me in?
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. It is the first Monday of the month, and you know what that means. It means that I have a fabulous scientist to talk about science in a way that makes us actually think we understand it. So without further ado, I would like to welcome Maya Belezny. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being on the show. So Maya, tell me a little bit before we get into the science portion. When did you discover that you liked science?
I would say I discovered that I liked science pretty early on. Mm-hmm. I always loved looking into the night sky and looking at the stars. In elementary school, the phases of the moon were really interesting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt that I always wanted to understand our natural world and really understand like what everything means and where everything comes from. So I feel like I've always had that feeling.
And were your parents able to answer any of the questions that you had?
No. My dad was a scientist back in the day, but he did a very different kind of science, so we weren't really speaking the same language.
But because he was a scientist, did he at least encourage your intellectual curiosity?
Absolutely.
What kind of science did he do?
He studied physics.
Oh, okay.
He studied atoms, so mm-hmm. very, very tiny things,
okay.
And very cold things, so...
So then how did you maintain that curiosity going through the school systems?
The high school education system can be a little bit deterring sometimes, I would say, for students, just because, you know, like worksheets can kind of squash out the interest that people have in science. But for me, I continued to like physics. I liked working through examples and understanding how things move and behave. So I think that stayed pretty constant for me throughout high school and going into college.
Okay. Did you go to high school here or? Because you mentioned that you you can speak Hungarian. So.
Yes. So my family's Hungarian, but I grew up in the United States and I went to high school in South Florida.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Ooh, Florida.
Yes.
And yet you still like science. That's excellent. So did you have good science teachers in high school?
I would say I did.
Okay.
Yes.
Feel that makes a huge difference, that the teachers that you have in the, you know, in the first 12 grades, that if you don't have good ones, you're never going to hang on to that. So when you go to college, you still love science, and do you go directly into the field that you want, or how did you discover what field you wanted to go into?
So I was pretty sure in high school that I wanted to study physics.
Okay.
And so I applied to college with that major, and I did that throughout.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was really the research that got me really interested in science. So when I started undergrad, I immediately reached out to professors to try to start doing research projects with them.
Okay. What was the first research project you did?
The first research project I did was with a professor at MIT, and he studied how clusters of galaxies merge together.
Okay.
There's kind of a lot there.
So your dad studied physics.
Mm-hmm.
You were like into space at first. Why didn't your dad actually know anything about space?
Everything is called physics, but the subfields are so different.
Okay.
You know, I'm thinking of things that weigh more than our sun, and he was thinking about individual atoms.
Oh.
So it's very different.
You're on the opposite ends of the spectrum,
yeah.
Really.
Yes.
So does he pepper you with questions about physics now?
Sometimes he asks me questions, but doesn't want to dive into the details about it very much. So he always says things like, oh, that was so long ago. I believe you. But he doesn't really want to start thinking again.
Oh, you're the scientist in the family now. I don't want to think about stuff like that anymore. I'm retired.
Kind of.
Got it.
So he likes hearing the interesting stories, but he doesn't want to have to think about it.
Got it. I kind of like that in a way. You don't have to, you know, there's no weird competition or anything like that. So let's talk about your branch of science. I read the description and the only word that sticks out to me is neutrino. So why don't you explain what it is that you do?
Yes. So in a really big picture, mm-hmm. I study what happens to supermassive stars after they die and what they sort of look like after they die. I'm specifically interested in what happens to the cores of these dead stars, how massive they can get, because mm-hmm. there's this big open question in physics of whether these cores can collapse into black holes or just stay these really dense, mm-hmm. like objects in space, basically. But I can break down.
Okay, so just when you talk about it, you have this enormous dead star, mm-hmm. and when it's dead, does that mean it stops giving off heat, or what does it mean to be a dead star?
Yeah, so I'll describe this a little bit more. Okay. The objects I study happen when stars that are 8 to 20 times the mass of our sun explode at the end of their lives.
Okay.
And when they explode, their whole outer shell comes off, and the only thing that's left is this super, super dense core at mm-hmm. the center.
Okay.
And this dense core is something we call a neutron star.
Okay.
Sometimes you can get not even a core after the explosion, but just total collapse into a black hole. But sometimes you retain this neutron star. And over time, this neutron star can start spinning really fast. Maybe it has another star going around it, and that's giving it more mass. And one of the biggest open questions in physics is, what is the maximum mass of this neutron star core?
Okay, I have a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to start with, what causes the star to explode in the first place?
Mm-hmm. So in all stars, including our sun, it's always a battle between gravity and pressure.
Okay.
So on the insides of stars, you're having nuclear fusion, which, you know, we have nuclear reactors on Earth. It's a great way to generate energy mm-hmm. and create outward pressure that kind of holds up the outside of the star.
Mm-hmm.
But then competing with that is the force of gravity that's pulling everything in. So the inside of the star is trying to keep the shell, like, pushing out, but then gravity is pulling everything in.
Okay.
And once you start, the fusion cycle starts with hydrogen, and then you go to heavier and heavier elements.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond a certain point, it takes more energy to fuse atoms than you gain from the reaction. So ultimately, gravity wins.
Okay.
Everything collapses inwards. And due to that sudden, rapid collapse, you get so much pressure suddenly at the middle that everything bounces back out into a supernova, it's called.
Okay. And so is the explosion of a star kind of predictable based on how big it is, or is it random?
It's predictable.
Okay.
So anything that's less than 8 times the mass of our sun will kind of just fizzle out. Maybe it'll blow off its part of its outer shell, but it won't have this dramatic supernova explosion that really massive stars do.
Okay.
So our sun won't explode in this way. It'll kind of just
peter out?
Fizzle out, yeah. It'll become a red giant at some point, but then after that it'll just cool down and be very red and cold.
So is it kind of like a giant block of charcoal out there in the universe?
Kind of. Different composition, but basically, yeah.
Okay. So you have this star that's blown apart, but not so blown apart that the core gets blown apart. So mm-hmm. you've got this floating thing, and then you say it starts to spin. Why does it start to spin? And does that spinning and gaining energy, can it turn into a new star?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's a great question, and a lot of that is actually still a bit debated.
Okay.
The, you know, every most things in the, actually everything in the universe is spinning. So like our Earth is spinning. That's why we have days. The galaxy's spinning, the sun spin, everything's spinning. And so for these neutron stars, that initial explosion can give it a little bit of kick and start a spinning, which generates a magnetic field. And that's also pretty interesting. But some of these neutron stars actually have a binary companion. So there's another star orbiting around it. And it's this orbit that you can kind of imagine it as like a violent swing dance. Like they're just going around and around each other and they're kind of spinning each other up.
Okay.
And not only that, but I guess I should describe these neutron stars, the way to think about them is physically they're the size of a city. Like they are the size of Manhattan.
Okay.
It's not their like physical size that's crazy. It's the mass that they can cram into this size. Okay. So within an area the size of Manhattan, you can have two times the mass of the sun packed into it. And that's why these are these really borderline objects where they're really the most dense objects in the universe besides a black hole. And that's why we wonder if they can collapse into a black hole. But the point is, like, they're physically small but very massive. And so when another binary or another kind of star is dancing around it, its mass gets stripped off and pulled onto this very dense neutron star. And that makes the neutron star gain even more mass.
Okay, but the neutron star is, for all intents and purposes, a dead star.
Yes.
There's a live star that's dancing with it, getting its shell or pulled off.
Yes.
Does the dead star trigger a trigger a reaction from the other star that also kills it?
So it can affect its evolution, but you know, for the most part, all that's doing is mass is being stripped from the live star by this dead neutron star.
Okay.
And the live star, you know, although it is losing material, it's not being ripped off suddenly so quickly that like that star's life is altered in a significant way.
Okay.
And so that live star can also go through a similar evolution. If it's really massive, it can undergo the same type of explosion, in which case you're left with a double neutron system after both of them have exploded.
Okay.
You can also have just a more boring sun-like star orbiting around it.
Okay.
And so really the most interesting systems are these binary systems where somehow the swing dance survives all these explosions. You know, whether it ends up as two neutron stars or one neutron star and sort of a shriveled up dead star. But if these binaries can stay intact through these explosions, then we have a really interesting system because that neutron star is probably really massive because of the sort of mass that's been poured on by the companion over a long time.
Okay. So, no, and it's gravity that's pressing in and the reactions that are pressing out.
Yes.
Okay. So when these two stars are dancing together, I guess, why doesn't... Is it like magnets where they kind of repel each other, or do they ever just sort of collide and become one star?
Yeah, that's also a pretty big question. So there's some systems where we see the companion star, the sort of live star, getting closer to the neutron star. So like it's spinning around it, but kind of in a spiral going inwards.
Okay.
For some systems, we don't see this at all. And it's hard to detect mergers of these systems. With there's a new gravitational wave detector that can detect when two neutron stars collide. But I think the systems I'm more interested in are just a neutron star and a boring star, and we haven't seen the merger of something like that before. So we think that they don't really spiral in so much that they always collide, but it is possible.
Okay, okay. Now, how have humans witnessed these stars, or is it all theoretical?
So we do measure them. Yes, we do measure them. These systems are really interesting because they kind of cover the whole electromagnetic spectrum. So the light we see with our eyes is called visible light. And that's only a very small range of the electromagnetic spectrum. We're talking on the radio. These neutron stars emit in the radio waves as well.
Oh.
So you can actually hear them sometimes.
Really?
Yeah.
What do they sound like?
They sound like very rapid beats. So, you know, some of these spin with like 1 second intervals.
Uh-huh.
So like the entire star rotates one time per second. So you would hear something like,
wow, they're that fast?
And some even go at millisecond periods.
Wow. It feels like it's moving so fast that you couldn't even really witness it moving. Like, wouldn't it feel, it feels like it's going so fast that it looks like it's standing still.
Yeah.
So how do you know that it's actually spinning?
Yeah, so we use radio for this.
Okay.
What you can do is you can kind of tune your radio station, just like how our station is 89.5.
Mm-hmm.
You can tune to certain frequencies and search for a pulse within those frequencies.
Okay.
So these millisecond pulses to our ears would just sound like a continuous sound. Like,
okay.
Something like that.
Uh-huh.
And if you get your sort of tuning right, you can actually detect individual pulses within that, and that would indicate to you that there's a neutron star there that's spinning.
So did scientists think that it was a solid sound at one point and then figured out that it would know that it was actually, that small of an interval?
So that actually took a really long time because scientists started discovering pulsars by this kind of method that I described, but they discovered the slow ones, the ones that sound like discrete sounds to our ears.
Okay.
They didn't even think that anything could spin with millisecond periods. That's like 1 second divided by 1,000. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's so, so short.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of anything that spins that fast.
Okay.
And so
huge, too.
So huge. And people didn't think to search those frequency ranges because they just didn't think it was possible.
Uh-huh.
But then radio surveys that covered those frequencies just pointed to the sky to see what they could see. And that's when these really fast pulsars or spinning neutron stars started to be discovered.
But again, how did they figure out that it was milliseconds when, first of all, they didn't even think it was possible, and you're looking up, and how did they figure it out? That's what blows my mind.
Yeah, so, you know, when I think the idea with radio astronomy is, like, if you've hit the right frequency,
uh-huh.
you know,
uh-huh.
it's, you can just imagine, like, a peak at that frequency.
Okay.
And so it's not like you need to point to a neutron star and, like, I mean, you do see the pulses, but the point is that you have to tune your frequency to be in the right range.
Okay.
It can be like, you know, you're searching for the highest note on the piano by by hitting the 7 lowest notes, you know? So, like, you just need to be in the right, like, kind of range.
So was it an accident that they found it at first? Because it wouldn't seem like something that you would actively be looking for.
I think it was a huge surprise. I think, this was, I think, in around the 80s that the first millisecond pulsars were discovered.
Okay.
And at this time, a lot of theorists were really actively working on this. I don't know if you've seen the Oppenheimer movie, but this is one of his big questions, actually. Like,
okay.
He tried calculating this, and so theoretically, people were pushing for it, and that pushed observationists to kind of look in that frequency range.
So there was already a suspicion that it could be tinier increments?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
People were discovering, you know, pulsars with half a second periods and things like this. And then you kind of start naturally ask, can they go any faster? Why
sure.
shouldn't they go any faster? And then you can search for them.
So when they first came up with, you know, these millisecond ones, did it take a long time to get people on board with the concept? Or were people like, oh, well, you did it. You proved us wrong.
I think people were definitely convinced that they were there.
Okay.
It was very difficult to explain how they got spun up to these millisecond periods.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of goes back to the picture I was saying earlier, where you need another star that's kind of tugging at it and giving it mass that's spinning it up to these periods.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
So we're talking now about these stars that are spinning super rapidly. Now, I know that space is a vacuum and there's no air, so there's no friction, but does the spinning have an effect on its mass?
Definitely it does. These systems are super crazy because they need you need to know every branch of physics to deal with them. And so the speed at which they're spinning means you need to take into account general relativity. And
okay.
These types of corrections can change the mass by around 20% for uh-huh. things that are spinning really fast.
Okay. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, like, for example, we recently measured the most massive pulsar ever, which is 2.3 times the mass of the sun.
Okay.
And if you correct that for its spin, which is 1.6 milliseconds, you get around 2.2. So you take it down by around a tenth of the mass of the sun. So it is a pretty big correction.
Now, is it coming off as like atoms or is it coming off as actual debris?
It's more... It more has to do with the fact that the mass is rotating at like at just really, really fast.
Yeah.
And that can, that because it's moving, it has a different mass than something was stationary.
Oh.
This is kind of like Einstein's E equals MC squared.
Uh-huh.
So something that is at rest and not moving has different energy than something that is moving.
Energy, yes, but how why mass?
Because energy basically is mass when you so like I said E equals MC squared.
Yeah.
Most of the time people in physics just let C, which is the speed of light,
uh-huh.
be a constant.
Okay.
And so you're basically saying that E equals M.
Oh. Okay.
But this spin correction is not something we have to deal a lot with in practice because the example I gave of this star that we just measured is one of the most rapidly spinning ones.
Okay.
And the correction is there, but it's not huge. So really what we're usually just satisfied with measuring the mass of the neutron star, and we don't usually take into account the rotation correction.
Okay.
That's kind of a theoretical thing that people deal with.
Now, in order for my little brain to kind of picture it, I'm thinking of the Tasmanian devil from the cartoons that's just spinning.
Yes.
Is it staying in the same place in space, or is it moving through space?
Yep, this is a great question. So when you go back to this initial explosion that created this core, that can, you know, it can give it a spin kind of kick, but it can also give it like just any kick that pushes it in some random direction.
Okay.
And we see evidence for this because our galaxy is a spiral if you look at it from above, but it's flat if you look at it from the side. Mm-hmm. And if you look at it from the side, the pulsars that we expect to be the oldest are really far above or below the flat plane where we live.
Okay.
Which means that they got kicked so hard after their explosion that they're just flying out of our galaxy or just flying in a random direction.
Oh.
So there is a lot of evidence that they're moving and moving very fast.
So they're on the move. So they're, in my mind, they're just... For us, moving very slowly away. But can they crash into other things?
Anything can crash into anything. It's pretty unlikely.
Because the universe is so vast and empty.
Oh, okay. Everything is so empty. The closest star to us is 4 light years away. That means it would take us 4 years to reach it if we were traveling at the speed of light.
Okay.
So very unlikely that we're or any neutron stars are ever going to crash into anything.
But this neutron star, as it gets kicked out, the companion that's dancing with it also gets kicked out?
Oh, yes. The ones that have companions, the way we should kind of picture it is they spin, they are in a very, very tight orbit.
Mm-hmm.
We take 365 days to travel one time around our sun.
Mm-hmm.
These can take hours.
Oh, okay.
Hours.
Okay.
So these are super tightly bound. It's kind of like the moon and our Earth. we always see the same side of the moon. This mm-hmm. is called tidal locking.
Mm-hmm.
So the moon doesn't spin with respect to Earth. But like, so we always see the same face. And that's just because it's so close to the Earth.
Okay.
And it's the same kind of thing with these systems. So you have super dense neutron star, a very, very short distance between it. And then you have a companion. And the companion's face is always locked to the neutron star. So there's always a day side and always a night side. And
okay.
there's no such thing as days if you were to be on one of the companion stars.
Now, okay, when the star that, I'm going to say supernovas for lack
yes,
of a better,
that's
when,
a good word.
When it collapses, are there times when it didn't have a companion but got one once it collapsed?
People think so. People think so. It's less likely, but a process that's kind of similar to what you described about stars crashing into each other,
mm-hmm.
you can have situations where kind of stars fly by each other and get captured in mm. each other's gravities. And so some systems show evidence that they didn't evolve together, but they were rather captured in some pretty random way. But I don't think that's very common. It's
okay.
not very common.
Now I have some pretty basic questions. So when we talk about the galaxy, and I know that the word planet evolves from like wandering star. So to me, that says that planets are pretty stationary. Is that correct? Stars are stationary. Is it correct to think that stars pretty much stay in their relative position as the galaxy floats around?
That's pretty fair to say, yeah. So every galaxy has a really massive black hole in the middle that keeps it all together.
Okay.
By massive, I mean millions to billions times the mass of the sun.
Wow.
So if you took like a billion suns, just squish them into a black hole, that would give you enough gravity basically to keep a whole galaxy together. And so each galaxy has just a huge black hole in the middle,
mm-hmm.
and then these spiral arms going around it. And so our position, like the spiral arms rotate with the black hole,
mm-hmm.
but we live in one of these arms and we kind of just stay where we are inside that arm.
Okay.
So we are rotating around this black hole that's controlling our entire galaxy,
uh-huh.
but we're not really, we don't have a lot of motion within that. So we're kind of fixed in our position if you,
okay.
I think that's a good.
So I know that we're sort of in the boonies of our galaxy, and you say that there's a black hole, which in my mind is a collapsed star?
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure. Go ahead.
No, so if there's this black hole, this collapsed star that's in the middle of the galaxy, and we're out in the boonies, how do we know that it's there, number one? Does it have a name? How do scientists refer to it? And is there a possibility of seeing it?
Yeah, so in our galaxy, that's pretty difficult to do because we are inside the plane of the galaxy. So like if you imagine it as a pancake, we're in the pancake trying to see the middle of the pancake. So
okay.
There's a lot of dust. There's a lot of stuff in the way. But we have imaged black holes. The name of the one that was imaged and got the Nobel Prize for it was called M87.
Okay.
And so you can resolve the, I mean, it's hard to kind of see what a black hole is, but you can see that the middle is dark and there's kind of shredded stars all around it that give you light. And so, yeah, I guess in our galaxy, there is a supermassive black hole. The black holes at the centers of galaxies aren't just single stars dying.
Mm-hmm.
They are the result of galaxies merging together over billions of years.
Okay.
So these supermassive black holes are actually like the combination of a bunch of older black holes.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's how they get so massive, because we don't know of stars that can explode and give a 10 million solar mass or 1 billion solar mass black hole at the end. So,
okay.
Yeah.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to 89.5 FM KPOO San Francisco. We're speaking with Maya Belezne about neutrinos and neutrons and all kinds, you know, all things that begin with words that I barely understand.
Yes.
But you're helping me. So let's talk about the specific way that you study it. So tell us a little bit about your research and what's a typical day in your research existence.
Yes. So my research is measuring the masses of neutron stars. That's what I'm most interested in.
Okay.
I'm specifically interested in measuring the systems that have the most massive neutron stars. These are these tight binary systems that I described.
Mm-hmm.
In these systems, as I mentioned, the companion star is more valuable for my observations than the neutron star itself. So I actually only look at the companion.
Why is it more valuable?
So for me, I work in the optical regime. That's the regime that we can see with our eyes.
Okay.
There's other regimes like radio. Those are way longer wavelengths. And there's also gamma rays and other types of emission.
Okay.
Everything comes out of these systems. The neutron star itself only emits in the radio or the gamma rays, so it's invisible to us optically.
Okay.
No optical light comes from the neutron star, but the really high energy rays coming off of the neutron star can penetrate the companion that's orbiting around it in a matter of hours. And so what ends up happening is we can basically see the phases of the companion like we see the phases of the moon. So because only one face is heated, when we can see, there's a time where the kind of butt of the companion is to us. And then there's another time where the face of it is kind of pointing to us. And by kind of backside and face, I mean the side that's illuminated and the side that's cold.
Okay.
And
okay.
So, you know, on the time scale of hours, these phases are changing because these rotate so fast or these orbit so fast. And so, and that phase is visible to us in the optical.
Okay.
Because that star is more similar to our sun and we can see our sun.
Okay.
So it's, I guess a good way to think about it would be like, if our sun had a dark side, like, and every few days we kind of saw a different side
of the sun.
You know, and it wasn't just uniformly bright everywhere.
Okay.
And so by measuring this light, I can determine how long the orbit takes.
Uh-huh.
For example, I recently just measured one that has a 75-minute orbit, which
Ooh.
Is super short.
Like, okay.
That's less than a class. You can sit through class and then it has changed phases already, it has completed an entire orbit.
So would you just sit there and watch the whole orbit and go, is it satisfying when you see it?
It's really, really satisfying. So I have to observe these with either space-based telescopes or ground-based telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
When you're observing with a ground-based telescope, you can actually see the images that they're taking in real time, and you kind of have some control over that. And so what I'm seeing is literally a picture of the sky, I know the coordinate of my source, and sometimes I see a bright spot there, and then sometimes it disappears.
Okay.
Like, I can see with my eyes the phase of it, because it's going into and out of view. Because all I'm looking at is the companion and what fraction of it is lit up at that time.
Now, you talked about the ground telescopes and space telescopes.
Mm-hmm.
We're sending telescopes to space now?
So, for example, the famous James Webb Space Telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope.
Okay.
Astronomers have the opportunity to propose science missions for these telescopes. They're very competitive, and you can't always rely on getting them.
But they're not actually out.
They are.
They are.
They orbit with our Earth around the sun.
Okay.
The James Webb Space Telescope, I think, is a couple thousand kilometers above our atmosphere, and it's just there in space and taking coordinates for scientists to measure interesting sources.
So you have this space telescope out there. Is it the space telescope that is sort of randomly discovering these entities, these neutrinos, and then people get excited and they jot down the coordinates and they're like, we're going to discover that next. We're going to study that next.
Honestly, kind of. So there's a lot of space-based telescopes that operate like how you described. They're a survey. So they don't, you know, point to a certain region because someone wants to. Mm-hmm. They just have a fixed schedule for where in the sky they're going to scan. Mm. And then that data is available to everybody. Okay. And everyone can try to identify. That's how actually this explosion of pulsar discovery happened, because there was an instrument who did this in the gamma ray. And nobody knew, like, what can emit so many gamma rays. And so you have this survey. There's some bright points of interest in the image. And then individual teams follow up on those points. And then, so these are kind of surveys. Mm-hmm. Then there's missions like James Webb, where every night where it's pointing is determined by someone's science goal. Mm-hmm. So you can propose to study this object, and so then James Webb that night will point to it.
Okay.
So it doesn't really operate like a survey, and its data can't be accessed by everybody because a team had to propose for it's their data.
Okay.
And so there's kind of, two classes of instruments, both on the Earth and in space.
So then we're going to go back to, you're using the ground telescopes to watch this 75-minute rotation. Was it something that you already knew about, or was it something that got discovered on your watch?
So this particular system was discovered in 2014.
Oh, okay.
And people had done a targeted observation of it already, mm-hmm. but the data were a little bit confusing to understand. And so what we did is we searched for data in a different wavelength range, just a little bit longer than visible light, so kind of infrared, like night vision kind of wavelength.
Uh-huh.
And we saw something interesting there, and I'm working on finishing up that result right now. But so I guess the way it works in general with pulsars is there's a discovery from a survey.
Mm-hmm.
A team might follow up on it. The initial data might be confusing, and then mm-hmm. you get, like, you know, 2 to 3 to 4 papers that are concerted observations of this to try to come up with a story for it.
Okay. And then so you're looking at the papers, and that determines – that's how you find out that the research is happening, is that you're reading these papers about these intriguing questions.
Yes.
Okay. And
yes.
Then you're going, that's something I want. I want to know that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay. So in my mind, whenever something appears on a screen that people weren't expecting, I would imagine like the whole room is just thrilled, and they're like, can we see it again? Is that accurate, or is it more just sort of very matter of fact?
I think it's definitely a more gradual process than that. So when you do get an answer, people are excited about it,
mm-hmm.
but it's usually not this very clean aha moment. We're kind of entering a time where we're sort of past this initial burst of pulsar discovery.
Okay.
And now we know that they exist, and we have to come up with better stories for them. And so I guess I'm not, you know, we're not trying to prove that these exist anymore, but we're really trying to have a theory for their evolution, explain why their light has the characteristics that it does, et cetera. So I think the pool of pulsars or spinning neutron stars that we can choose from is a little bit fixed right now.
Like, okay.
We're not going to discover a ton of new ones from a survey because there just isn't a survey that's looking for them right now.
Okay.
But we are spending a lot of energy trying to better understand the ones that we do know about.
Okay. In your studies and in your research, what was something that you learned about that kind of blew your brain open?
So we had a really interesting result recently where we actually were able to get time with James Webb mm-hmm. to observe a very interesting system. So this system has a 2-millisecond neutron star so it's spinning really, really fast, and it has a companion in around a 7-hour orbit, I think.
Okay.
So it's a little bit slower than the one I was mentioning.
But still, you can watch it in a day.
It's still pretty crazy.
Okay.
And we took spectra of it, so we just see how the light, like how much light you get for a given wavelength.
Mm-hmm.
And what we saw was that there's the weirdest composition on the surface of it, and you could basically call it a diamond planet because it was entirely made out of carbon.
Really?
Entirely made. For reference, our sun is 75% hydrogen,
okay,
25% helium, and less than 1% heavier elements.
Okay.
Most things in space are like this.
Mm-hmm.
On Earth, most of everything is hydrogen.
Okay.
So the fact that there's no hydrogen on the surface of this. There's no helium either that we can detect, although we're working on trying to detect that.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
There's no oxygen. There's no nitrogen. All the things that exist on Earth and every other star,
yeah.
They're completely absent. All we see is carbon molecules. Some of the molecules are so rare that we don't even have data for them from the lab, so we can't even model it. We know it's there from solving chemical equations,
uh-huh,
basically, but we don't know what the spectrum is supposed to look like because no one has even measured these molecules before.
Wow. To me, I'm imagining like a giant, something that looks like glass that's out there.
That's honestly kind of a not bad picture for it.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So this brings me back to a question I have kind of frequently. When I'll see, like, you'll get a post, not a poster, but a calendar of galaxies and, you know, of space.
Mm-hmm.
And there are all these amazing colors. Whereas when I look through a telescope, I just see like a couple of dots and they're like, oh yeah, that's Jupiter, that's Venus. And I'm like, I'm taking your word for it. So what is it that you actually see when you're looking at stuff? Are you seeing a tiny dot and extrapolating from that? Are you seeing colors or are those just colored? What is it?
Yes, so that's a great question. And the photos you see about space can be a little bit misleading. They're not fake, but the idea is that you can put a filter in front of your telescope, say a red filter,
mm-hmm,
that only lets red light through.
Okay.
And so what these images that you see usually are images taken in a bunch of different filters.
Like composited together.
And then, yeah. And then so like, for example, the red data, you can color that with red,
mm-hmm,
and then you stack it with all the other data. And that's how you get these layered, like very rich, beautiful images of space. So you're not just snapping a single photo of it, but you're stacking what that same area looks like in a bunch of different filters.
But when you're looking at it with the naked eye, with the naked telescopic eye,
yeah,
is it just white light or gray light?
It's just, yeah, black and white, gray. So the, you know, sky is like very dark, black, maybe gray if there's a lot of atmospheric activity.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then the stars themselves look like white point sources. And so what I'm really doing is I'm counting like how much light comes from each pixel in my image.
Oh, yikes.
So it's really not like working with those beautiful Hubble James Webb images that you, mm-hmm, see on the internet. In practice, the raw data that you work with is a little bit less exciting.
It's
visually.
Literally like pixel size. You don't even get like a tiny like, I don't know, pinprick or
something? It depends. Yeah, it depends on the quality of your instrument. But
okay.
Sometimes the source I'm looking at is like 5 pixels big, and sometimes all the light disappears when its night side is facing us. So it can be challenging, definitely, to extract these data. These pulsars can be very faint. So
sure. So as you're looking at these things and extracting this data, what will be... Is there a practical application of the use of this data, or is it really just because mankind wants to understand everything?
You know, I think these data specifically are for the question that we're trying to answer with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't, you know, think that there's a ton of practical use for the data themselves. If I were to just give it out to everybody, I think it's super interesting, and
sure,
I think everyone should look at it and understand it. But,
mm-hmm,
from advancing humanity forward, I don't think that just these images that we're taking alone can really contribute a lot. But I will say that in general, I think astrophysics is a great field because the discoveries you make from these data,
mm-hmm,
drive new technology and new instruments that are aimed to like kind of probe, like you sort of get one answer maybe in three new questions from looking at your data, and then you build a new instrument and explore it further. And the technologies that come from these instruments have really actually affected our lives a lot. Like MRI machines exist because of space research.
Really? How so?
Because the like magnetic resonance transitions that they measure are measurements that were originally used for like astrophysical purposes. They were trying to measure, I think, some cosmological effect with it in like the 80s. And so that was kind of a trickle down technology that helped with medicine.
Wow.
Yeah.
People are amazing that they can take something, some technology that they've learned from space and go, hey, you know what? I bet we could do something with it other than porn.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. I mean, but I think that's so important. And I really, you know, space research has been kind of something that drove America forward for such a long time. And mm-hmm. I think it still should, because it's hard to justify why studying this pulsar will improve society. But I think it's a longer game than that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
describe your most exciting day in the lab, or your most exciting research day. For you, it doesn't have to be for, you know, but mm-hmm. something you were like, wow, this was a great day. I'm really glad I chose this field.
So I have to, you know, fit models to the data that I measure.
Mm-hmm.
And when a model works, it's very clear that it worked and it's really satisfying.
Okay.
What you kind of should picture is like the data that I look at look like sine waves. So
I don't know what a sine wave is.
It literally is just like, it looks like an ocean wave, kind of. It goes up and then it goes down and it goes up and it goes down with like some fixed period.
Oh, okay.
So it's just like a squiggle going constantly in time.
Like a Doppler wave or something.
Yeah. Okay. And so I basically have to fit lines to these optical signals, and when I get my parameters right, it's very clear that I have a story for this object. I'm able to describe all of the light that's coming from it and all wavelengths, and like I have a story for it, because these systems can be really complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's usually not just a neutron star and a companion. Sometimes there's shocked wind that's flying off of the system. Sometimes there's a disk.
Wait.
Sometimes
shocked wind and what is what?
So
I don't know what that is.
You know, you can get as the companion spins around the neutron star,
mm-hmm.
its side that faces the neutron star is like a fireball, and it's like whizzing through space.
Okay.
And so if you imagine that the front of the star is like burning, you can see that there can be some like fire or like wind kind of coming off of it, and it's like leaving
God.
A trail as
okay.
it's going through space.
Okay.
Then, you know, it's possible that there was a disk around the neutron star at some point from the mass of the companion going around it and spiraling around it.
You mean like Jupiter has that or Saturn has the
rings.
Ring?
Yeah, it can be something like that. Yes.
From like this burning thing just leaving smoke and debris around it.
Yes.
Wow.
So it's usually a pretty messy system. So
sure.
It's not as clear as just modeling the phases of the
mm-hmm.
companion, but
mm-hmm.
you have to take into account all this extra light that's coming from all these different places in the binary orbit. So
on a good day, the model works just right, and you say, hurrah!
Yeah, yeah.
Question, does it ever come to pass that you'll have this this neutron star, this neutron core,
mm-hmm.
with more than one companion?
Ooh. Oh my gosh, I can't think of an example system, but I don't see why not.
Okay.
I don't see why not. You can, because you definitely can have, you know, double neutron stars or two neutron stars orbiting each
mm-hmm,
other.
Mm-hmm.
But they've had examples of planets orbiting neutron stars.
Sure, okay.
And so, like, I think there is a neutron star with two planets around it. So
okay.
there's definitely room for triple systems.
Okay. Now, explain to me once again how the neutron stars differ from the core that is, that our galaxy has? Mm-hmm.
So our galaxy has a supermassive black hole at its core.
Okay.
That small black holes can form when really massive stars explode.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just nothing to oppose gravity after their explosion. So everything just collapses into nothing.
Okay.
And then over time, these can merge and become larger and larger. And so you get something that's at the center of our solar system.
Mm-hmm.
These neutron stars are the result of the explosion of a star in the same way that creates smaller black holes,
mm-hmm.
except there the gravity wasn't so strong that it destroyed the core. Instead, you have something that is really dense and very small left behind,
okay.
but it's still not dense enough to just collapse into absolute nothing.
So in collapsing into absolute nothing, I think of nothing as taking up no space and having no energy. Are you saying that the center of our galaxy has collapsed into like a million nothings?
I guess that's not the – that wasn't the best wording for me. Like when I say nothing, I just mean I don't know what's inside of it.
Oh,
I
okay.
don't know. If you sort of imagine like holding a piece of fabric and then dropping like a ping pong ball on it,
mm-hmm.
the fabric, you know, it'll hold up the ping pong ball and it'll indent a little bit,
mm-hmm.
But it's still there. But if you were to drop like 100-pound weight on it, that fabric would kind of, you know, fall with the weight and create this really deep well
mm-hmm.
that it would be much harder to climb out of.
Okay.
And so that's kind of what a black hole is. It's something that once you go into it, you can't come back out because it's just pulling
right.
on space-time so hard.
When I was a kid, that was like I would watch those programs about black holes, and it was the biggest worry. One
yeah.
of the bigger worries as a 10-year-old was, are we going to get sucked into a black hole?
You know, I did have that fear as well at some point. I was like, if they're black holes, we can't even see them. Like,
yeah.
we don't know.
You just suddenly wouldn't be there.
Yeah.
You'd just be part of it. Okay.
We will not be consumed by a black hole.
I feel we'll be fine.
I'm
an older person now, so I get that. But then, if you have enough of these neutrinos that start to join each other, they still will never turn into something that could form a galaxy. Right?
Right, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So the core that we have is so dense that it doesn't have a core. It's just mystery energy.
It's just a huge black hole.
Okay.
It's just
really, some mystery. Whereas the things that you study
mm-hmm.
you actually know what it's made up of. It's like the glass planet.
Yes. So we know we're not really sure what goes on in the middles of neutron stars.
Mm-hmm.
We can describe their binary companions pretty well. But this really is the big question. Like, we don't know if a neutron star will collapse into a black hole. Idea is like, you know, if you have an atom, for example, the hydrogen atom, you have
mm-hmm.
a proton in the middle and an electron flying around it.
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of imagine like the energy levels of the electron as like sort of different shaped bubbles that surround the nucleus, like
okay.
the thing in the middle. And so in most stars, or, you know, in certain stars, the pressure is so high that you're kind of squishing these bubbles of electrons together, but their pressure is keeping it up. Now, neutron stars are one step like further than that. You've destroyed these electron orbitals, and instead its nuclei are pushing together.
Okay.
And so the big question is at what point does this pressure become not enough? At what point does this succumb to gravity? So this is sort of like the last kind of push from nature to avoid collapse, but we don't really know what the limit of that is yet.
And with that cliffhanger, I was so engrossed in all of this, I lost track of time and we're out of it. So, but I want to thank you, Maya, so much for being on the show. Why don't you give a quick plug to the lab that you're working for, the person you're doing the research for?
Oh, yes. Thank you so much. This was amazing. I work for Roger Romani at Stanford University, and if you look him up online, he has some fascinating talks about this topic in a very approachable way. So I would recommend looking up Roger Romani for pulsars, black holes, and other exciting things.
Excellent. And I also want to give a shout out to Wonderfest, who provides me every month with amazing science envoys. Maya Belesne, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you.
All right. I can hear the dulcet tones of Mr. Ford, who's ready to pleasure your ear holes. So I'm going to leave you with the seatbelts. And what planet is this? Until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.